This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Here's that Lot has been involved in the war of the four and the five kings, and he goes out to save Lot. In the process, he saves the kings on the side of Lot, among them the king of Sodom. Vayomer Melech Sodom el Avram, and the king of Sodom says to Avram, Ten li ha-nefesh v'horuchush kaflo. Give me my people back, and you take any of the loot you keep. I don't need that, just give me the people. Vayomer Avram el Melech Sodom, and Avram said to the king of Sodom, Harimoisi yodi el Hashem kevil yoyin tene shamayim voretz. I raise my hand up in earth to Hashem, the highest God, who owns heaven and earth. In michut v'ad tzroich now, from a thread to a shoeless, v'yimekach mikol asher loch, that I shall not take from anything that is yours. V'loi soymar, so that you shall not say, Anihe sharti es Avram, I made Avram wealthy. But one day when I become wealthy, you're not going to claim the credit for it. Says Rashi, Shakodush Boruchu iftichani le'oshrani shenema v'averechecho. For the Ribbono Shel Olam has promised to make me rich, and you're not going to claim credit for it. Therefore I won't take anything. Firstly, how did Avram turn down such an opportunity? The Ribbono Shel Olam says, I will make you rich. Maybe this is the bracha of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Straight after that, he goes out to war, miraculously wins the war, and is showered with the loot from the war, which the king of Sodom abandons any claim towards and says, you take it, keep it. Surely any normal thinking person would have said, oh, that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam meant when he said, I'll make you rich. Look at this, Min HaShemayim, how quickly it happened. He's just told me I'm going to be wealthy, and look at this, here it all is, Min HaShemayim. Instead, Avraham Avinu says, no, thank you. This isn't what the Ribbono Shel Olam meant when he said, I'll make you wealthy. He has other ways of doing it. How did Avraham know that this wasn't what the Ribbono Shel Olam meant? Excuse me. Secondly, how could he have thought that the king of Sodom was going to claim the credit? This was a most amazing war. The king of Sodom and all his people were totally vanquished by a most powerful group of kings. They were so powerful that they were in the majority. The five kings were in the majority, but the four kings were far, far stronger. And in fact, on the way, just by the way, these four kings smote the Rephoim, and they smote the Zuzim, and they smote the Amim. Now these weren't ordinary people. We have reference to some of these people in Dvorim, in chapter 2, where the Rephoim, Rashi says, why are they called Rephoim? Al Shem Shekol HaRoye Oysom Yodov Mitrafis. Anybody who used to see the Rephoim used to collapse in fear. Never mind coming into contact with them. And the four kings, just by the way, on their way, just vanquished them and finished them. And who were the Amim? Al Shem She'emosom Muteles HaAbriyus. The Amim, their fear was reigned over humanity. The whole world was afraid of the Amim. And these four kings come and they wipe them out. And after that, they wipe out Sodom and his four colleagues. So there was no question that the king of Sodom was finished. He had no chance. He was completely ruined. Comes Avraham Avinu. Who did he come with? A very big army. By Yishma Avram ki Nishbochi, when Avram hears that his brother has been captured, by Yorechet Chanichov, those who were born in his home, Shemayna Osir Shleishmois, 318, that was the size of the army of Moshe Rabbeinu. Vayildef of Avraham Avinu, Vayildef Adon, and he pursued them until dawn. So who's he going to save? These five nations who've been vanquished, together with a whole lot of other more powerful nations, who've been vanquished by these four kings. And Avraham Avinu sets out with 318 men, And according to Chazal, it wasn't even 318 men, it was two men, Avraham and Eliezer. They set out, they did it all on their own. And it was the most miraculous war, it was a supernatural war. Chazal tell us, where did Avraham get arms from and ammunition? There were sanctions in those days against Avraham. People weren't supplying him willingly with arms and ammunition, because don't forget, Avraham, you know, used to practice apartheid. He didn't treat everybody alike. He used to treat idol worshippers differently to the way he used to treat Ma'amini. He used to treat fine people differently to the way he used to treat grob people. So you can imagine that there were heavy sanctions against him. Where did he get his ammunition from? Says the Medrash, if he wanted a sword, he picked up a bit of sand in his hand, it turned into a sword. If he wanted arrows, he picked up a straw, and the straw turned into an arrow. And all this was seen by the king of Sodom. They knew they had no chance. They saw this was a miracle. What chance is there that in years to come, the king of Sodom would say, I made you wealthy? You made me wealthy? Where were you when I set up? You were in concentration camps when I came. I liberated you. You made me wealthy. How does Avraham suspect that the king of Sodom might even come to say one day, that I made Avraham wealthy? And not only does Avraham suspect it, he knows it for a fact. That's what will happen. If I take even a shoelace from you, king of Sodom, I know you're going to say that you made me wealthy. And says Avraham, after all, the Ribbono Shel Olam has promised me, and I shall bless you and make you wealthy. And Moshe Rabbeinu, and Avraham Avinu makes a calculation that the purpose of that wealth is only for Kiddush Hashem. There's no reason the Ribbono Shel Olam would make me wealthy in this world if it's not to further sanctify the name of Hashem himself. And if some human being is going to claim that he was the source of my wealth, there goes the Kiddush Hashem. And that's how Avraham Avinu works out that this cannot be what Ribbono Shel Olam meant when he said, I will make you wealthy. I will make you wealthy and it will be a Kiddush Hashem. But if the king of Sodom is going to claim credit, that will be no Kiddush Hashem. Therefore Avraham Avinu says, this can't be what it means. It's not possible. How many of us would be able to be open and honest enough to turn down great opportunity because it's not quite in accordance with what the Ribbono Shel Olam really wants? Something one has to understand, to build. After all, we would have argued what a Kiddush Hashem it would be. The whole world will know that Avraham Avinu has become wealthy. And how has he become wealthy? By a miraculous war fought against the four kings, the four most powerful kings in the world, who overcome the entire world of that time with their might. And Avraham sets out with one other man, and virtually single-handedly they wipe out the four kings. And they release the prisoners, the five kings and their nation and their people. Surely that would be a great Kiddush Hashem. But there's a danger. There's a politician involved. And to take something from a politician can't lead to Kiddush Hashem. That's going to be ultimately used for the interests of the politician. For that's what politicians are. They use situations for their own expedience. And that cannot lead to the Ratzon Hashem. That can't be what the Ribbono Shel Olam really wants. There are a lot of arguments and discussions and debates and fights that take place in Eretz Yisrael today about the funding of yeshivas by the government. The yeshivas claim they're not getting enough funds, and the irreligious people claim the yeshivas are getting too much funds. What's interesting is that there is a small group of Rosh Yeshiva, a very small group, who don't accept funds from the government. The question of how much they won't accept. The group of Brisker Yeshivas, some of the others, won't accept a penny. One thing they're sure of, if that's the way for Torah to survive, by receiving handouts from politicians, that's not the Ratzon Hashem. That's their view, that's their belief. That can't turn out a Kiddush Hashem. It must turn out a Chilul Hashem. If we get too much, they're going to complain. If we get too little, there'll be complaints. Whatever happens. And they have a handover. My brother asked his Rosh Yeshiva, the Meir Soloveitchik, what cheder to send his children to. The Meir gave him the name of a cheder and said, you send them to that cheder, because that cheder doesn't take funds from the government. That means everything they do is Altarach HaKodesh. They have no other interests. They don't have to please the government. They're not funded by the government. They don't have to report to the government. What they do is Alpito. And if there won't be enough funds, I once asked Rav Meir, what would you do if you don't have funds at the end of the month? And he looked at me incredulously and says, I closed the yeshiva. What do you mean if I don't have funds? That means the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want me to operate. So I close. I don't have to fight. I close. Once one gets involved with politics, and once one gets involved with money, one has to know that the Torah is being threatened. It's virtually impossible to synthesize emiskeit in Torah with monetary interest and with political interest. And it was for that reason that the Gedolei Yisrael opposed the founding of the chief rabbinate in Eretz Yisrael, and opposed the establishment of Heichal Shlomo in Eretz Yisrael, something which Reb Chaim Loza was very much opposed to, because once a Torah setup becomes an organization, it tends to move from being an organization to becoming a movement. And once it becomes a movement, it has policies. And once it has policies, it's involved in politics. And once Torah is involved in politics, it is no longer Torah. And so always throughout the years, Torah operated in small cells, small yeshivas, small kehillas, small Bosei Medrash. Sometimes the yeshiva became bigger. Very often it would then split into two smaller yeshivas. And even if it remained a large yeshiva, it didn't used to open branches all over the world. Talmidim would go up and open a second yeshiva somewhere else, but a yeshiva would send his Talmidim to open. But that second yeshiva was a yeshiva that stood on its own 2 feet and held its own and stood for its own and was administered and led by its own people. It wasn't part of a movement. The Gedolei Yisrael always feared the construction of a movement in Torah. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter spent the latter years of his life in Germany, away from Lithuania, where he had created the whole revolution that introduced Musar back into the yeshivas. And while he was in Germany, he was asked by his Talmidim to come back to Europe, to Lithuania. He was needed there. And he refused to go. This is something that nobody understands. How could the Israel have refused to go back to Europe? He founded the whole thing. And they needed him. And he's sitting in Germany, when in Eastern Europe, in Lithuania, they needed him. My father told me his belief is that Rabbi Yisrael was worried. He never intended Musar to become a movement, and it had become a movement, and he wanted it not to be associated with it anymore. It's doing its work fine, but if he was going back to Europe, he would go back as the head of a movement. And that he didn't want. All he wanted was that in every shtibl, in every yeshiva, in every shul, people should sit and learn Musar every day. That's all he wanted. He didn't want a movement. He didn't want a revolution. He wanted every Jew to change his lifestyle a little bit, but not to create a movement. And in fact, my father says, and I think he's right, that the wonderful sefer was written in several volumes called Tznuat HaMusar, sefer by the Dov Katz. Traces the Musar movement from Rabbi Yisrael right through. Very wonderful work. But my father says that Rabbi Yisrael would have been most upset with the title of that sefer, Tznuat HaMusar, the Musar movement. That's exactly what Rabbi Yisrael tried to avoid. That's exactly what he didn't want. He didn't want it to become a movement. But when a movement is created, a movement needs funding. And if a movement needs funding, it needs funds. And when a movement needs funds, its thinking changes. When a movement is founded, a movement has policies. When a movement has policies, it enters into politics. And when it enters into politics, its thinking changes. As long as Torah is operating in small cells, it is theoretically possible to keep it pure from money and from power and politics. The moment it becomes an international movement, it starts entering the field of politics. Avraham Avinu decides that as great as the Kiddush Hashem would be to become instantly wealthy through his miraculous victory, it would mean a partnership with a politician. That can't be the Ritzayin Hashem. That can't be what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. And so he says to the king of Sodom, "In michut v'ad tzveich now v'im ekach mikol hashelom. Not a thread and not a shoelace will I take from you. So that you will never say, as you inevitably will, if I take from you, anihei sharti yisavu, that I made Avraham wealthy." That would defeat the purpose of the Kiddush Hashem. But why was it so inevitable that the king of Sodom would have said that, firstly? And secondly, my great uncle Reb Elia asks an even more amazing question. The king of Sodom has seen these miracles. He's seen two people conquer the four kings. The four kings have conquered the world, and two people have conquered the four kings. These two people are now the world champions. And what do they look like? Can you imagine Avraham and Eliezer, two elderly Yidden, long beards, sitting and learning all day? What did they look like? They didn't look like soldiers exactly. And so clear was it that this was a miraculous victory, and in front of the eyes of the king of Sodom, he saw it all. In fact, when the Torah says that after the war they came, "Vayetze melech Sodom likrosoi achar eshuvu me'akosis kedo lo'omer bet hamlochim asher itoi," and the king of Sodom and the kings who were with him came to meet Avraham after his smiting of kedo lo'omer, "el emek shoveh," to the valley of shoveh. Shoveh means equality, says the Medrash. Rabbi Brechia and Rabbi Chanina, b'shem Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, "Sheshom hishvu koloi v'kechovit." There in that valley, for once in history, all the idolaters were achieved equality. "V'kotzatzu arozim," they chopped down cedar trees. "V'osu bima gedoilo," and they made an enormous stage. "V'yishivu oisoi b'seichel lamalo," and they put Avraham Avinu on that stage. Can you imagine all these idolaters coming around Avraham Avinu, giving him cover, building a stage, putting him on top on the throne? "V'yumekaltim lefonov," and they praised him. "V'yimrim loyim," they said to him, "Shomanu Adoini," we've heard Adoini and Avraham what you've done. "Omru loy," they said to him, "Meloich at oleinu," become our king. They offer Avraham Avinu the position of their king. "Nedat oleinu," become our president, our prince. "Eloiku atalinu," become our God, we'll worship you. Avraham has a chance of capturing the world. The world is not lacking its king. The world is not lacking its God. You don't need me, there's a Ribbono Shel Olam. So they know the miracles of Avraham Avinu, and they know that the Ribbono Shel Olam was behind it all. And which becomes the most evil center of humanity? Sodom. Very soon afterwards. To the point where the Ribbono Shel Olam has to utterly destroy it. Man, woman, child, buildings, the whole town has to be wiped out. Very seldom have we had any such destruction, any such total destruction. On that very same place, the Sodom, that had experienced firsthand the most unbelievable miracles. How often do you hear people saying that if we were exposed to the miracles that the Bnei Yisrael were exposed to, what tzaddikim we would be? If the Ribbono Shel Olam would reveal himself to us, how frum we would all be. There the Ribbono Shel Olam revealed himself to the king of Sodom and to the people of Sodom in the most miraculous way possible. They were prepared to accept Avraham Avinu as their king, as their rov, as their god, as anything. And shortly afterwards they've descended back to the levels of ultimate degeneracy. Asks Reb Elia, how could that be? Answers Reb Elia, a correct philosophy is half of the battle, but it's not the whole battle. To know what is true, that helps, and to know what is right is helpful. But that doesn't mean you're going to do what is right, as we've often discussed. At the end of the day,
It depends on character, not on chokhmah. You can have wise people, but to translate that wisdom into action needs character. And the bottom line of character is self-discipline, the ability to do what has to be done and not to do what mustn't be done. And says Rabbi Eliezer, but after years and years, decades, maybe centuries, of these people excelling in doing just as they please, because already before this we learned, when Lot and Avram split, the Torah already comments, the Anshei Sodom roim v'chatoim la'ashemoid, the men of Sodom were terribly wicked and sinful to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Says Rashi, roim begufom, they were evil in their bodies, v'chatoim b'mamoinom, and they sinned with their money. They knew about Hashem Yisbara. They had a tradition about the Ribbono Shel Olam, and still they practiced their evil. Says Rabbi Eliezer, when a person has become ingrained in doing as he pleases, in not standing up to his own desires and to his own cravings and to his own ambitions, no matter what philosophy you later achieve, you can't move away that easily from the habit of doing as you please. That perhaps is back to the Bisroel Salanter. The most important thing that he tried to teach is just that. That it's not sufficient to know what is right, to know the halacha, to know what is good, to know what is correct, that's not sufficient. To be able to practice that in adversity, that's what is needed. The self-discipline of putting that into practice is what Yiddishkeit is all about. And a person who is untrained in self-discipline, it doesn't help teaching Torah to him. You can teach him and teach him and teach him, it's not going to change him. The first thing he needs to be taught is to be disciplined. To be disciplined, one has to start with small things to discipline oneself. Discipline expresses itself in continuity. To go to a shir sometimes is not an act of discipline. That's an act of expedience. You go when you like, when you feel like it, when you can. To go to a shir when you can't, that's discipline. To daven, because you've got the time to daven, yes, there's nothing to do, mincha time comes and you've got a spare moment, that doesn't require self-discipline. When you're in the midst of an important meeting and mincha time is running out and you've got to excuse yourself to go and daven mincha, that's self-discipline. To give tzedakah when it doesn't hurt, that doesn't require self-discipline. But to identify a need in another person, whether it's a financial need or an emotional need or a physical need, when it does hurt, you've got other plans to use your money for, to use your time for, to use your energy for. And all of a sudden you're confronted with the need of another person and you divert your resources from yourself to the other person. That's discipline. To follow Torah and Halacha, even when it's not expedient, even when it's not promoting your own aims and your own ends, that's when it's important. That's when one has to have self-discipline and self-character. It works in small areas, the keeping of Siddurim, to come to a shir on time, to leave the shir on time, to be on time with all the things that one does, to inculcate into oneself a sense of punctuality, of reliability, that if I say I'll do something, it will be done. And if I say it will be done by Sunday, it will be done by Sunday, even if that means staying up the whole of Saturday night. And if it will be done by Wednesday, then it will be done by Wednesday. Just introducing into one's lifestyle that middle of discipline. Because without that, the Torah is a waste of time. Without that, all the knowledge in the world and all the shiurim and all the learning, it's all very pretty and very beautiful, but it remains philosophy. If one doesn't have the ability to master oneself, there's no way one can put that into practice except when it's easy to put it into practice, but that's not what the Ribbono Shelolam wants. He wants us to be able to put it into practice even when it's not easy to practice. That was something that the people of Sodom had not developed. They did what they wanted. They wanted to eat treif, they ate treif. They wanted not to give tzedakah, they didn't give tzedakah. Whatever they wanted, they did. And says Rebbe Eliyahu, after years of doing what you want, you can't suddenly do what is right. If you're trained in doing what you want, it doesn't help knowing what is right. You won't switch. You'll continue to do what you want even if it's wrong. Not sufficient to have correct thinking. One has to have the self-discipline to put that thinking into practice. We spoke last week and again at the Shalashudas this afternoon about the levels of Mesiras Nefesh. This afternoon we spoke about it in terms of Yeshiva Bochrin, that learning in Yeshiva today is easier than it used to be. Spoke about it last week in terms of Baalei Tshuva as well. It's easy to become a Baal Tshuva in the regular sense of the word today. It doesn't go against the trends that much. And the economies of the Western world are so constructed today that keeping Shabbos for most people is not that difficult. For some people it is a big Mesiras Nefesh, but for many it's not that difficult. It's pretty accepted. 5-day weeks all over the world are not unusual. The worst is that for Yom Tov one might have to take off one's leave. That's about the extent of one's Mesiras Nefesh to keep Shabbos today. It's not a big deal anymore. Kashrus is not a big deal anymore. If on the Kashrus list or on the Mahadrin list, never mind the Kashrus, there are not 6 types of sweets, people already are complaining. In the old days there wasn't one kind of sweet. You could hardly get meat, bread, milk was a problem. Today, what's the problem? And you go into any supermarket in any corner of the world and you find products of all sorts of Akshavim. Where's the Mesiras Nefesh? The answer is you don't need Mesiras Nefesh today to be frum in the normal sense of the world. And if it weren't for that, nobody would be frum. But to be really a Yorei Shamayim, to really become a Ben Torah, oh, do you need Mesiras Nefesh? To be able to be consistent, to be able to be reliable, to be able to be self-sacrificing, to be able to be contributive in all circumstances, no matter what the cost. For that one needs the Mesiras Nefesh. And that's the area in which we don't always excel as well as we do in the relatively simple areas of being true. What about Avraham Avinu? Avraham Avinu is the antithesis of Sodom. Avraham Avinu works out that there must be a Ribbono Shel. It takes him many, many years to work that out. He starts making progress at the age of 3, but it's only when he reaches middle age that he finally comes to the conclusion that there must be a Ribbono Shel Olam. Medrash brings in the beginning of the Seder, the famous Medrash, Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, Moshel Lechot Sheyoiveh Mimotzim Lamotzim. The person is walking, traveling by the way, V'ro Biro Achaz Delekes, and he sees a house on fire. Omar, he says, Tzimah Shabira Zubli, Mani, where's the Barabos here? What's going on? Hitzitol of Barabiro, Omar Le'aniu Barabiro. And the Barabos picks up, he says, I'm the Barabos. But hadn't the traveler commented, who is the Barabos, he would never have found the Barabos. So Avraham Avinu, says the Medrash, analyzed the world, studied the world, and came to the conclusion, there must be a Barabos, there must be a creator, there must be a Manig Hoylo. When he came to that conclusion, then the Ribbono Shel Olam says to him, I am the Baal HaBos. You're quite right, I am the Baal HaBos. But the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't reveal himself to Avraham until that point. What point was that? Avraham Avinu is thrown into the Kibshon Hoish for his beliefs, which are considered so unusual and so heretical to them. He was thrown into a furnace. At that point, that was his first Nisoyim, the first of 10 trials. At that point, had the Ribbono Shel Olam revealed himself yet to Avraham? No. At that point, Avraham Avinu had come to an intellectual conclusion that there must be a God. And if there's a God, one cannot serve idolatry, because that is deception, and that undermines the very foundation of ethics and morality. And therefore, when he's challenged, either give up your belief of monotheism or we'll throw you into the furnace, without ever having seen a prophetic sign of the Ribbono Shel Olam,
without ever having been exposed to the Ribbono Shel Olam. He wasn't taught it by his parents. He wasn't taught it by his Rabbein. He had no background in it and no tradition in it. He had no exposure to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Only his own thinking, only his own philosophy, his own mind compelled him to that conclusion.
And for that he's prepared to be Moser Nefesh. For that he's prepared to go into the oven. And it's only when he comes out alive that the Ribbono Shel Olam says to him, I'm the Balabos. You're right. I'm the one you went in for. You went into the fire, I pulled you out. But he didn't know that was going to happen. He went in fully expecting to die. Here we see the ultimate of self-discipline. The willingness to sacrifice the most powerful of all human drives, the drive for survival, for the sake of a belief. Because my mind tells me it's right. Exactly the opposite of Sodom. Sodom are incapable of doing anything, even if they know it's right. Even if it doesn't require Mesivus Nefesh, if it goes against their desires, they're incapable of doing it. They do what they want. Avraham Avinu does what is right, even at the expense of his life. Freedom is often thought of as the ability to do as one pleases. But that isn't freedom. We've often said that a dog does as he pleases, and a cat can do as she pleases, and a monkey can do as he pleases. There's nothing specifically human about doing as you please. Doing as you please is an animal activity, and there's no kedusha in such a thing at all. Freedom is the ability to do as one doesn't please. Freedom is the freedom to refuse, the freedom to say no. That's freedom. Usually that's seen in the ability to say no to somebody else. If your employer says to you, do such and such, and you say no, you're not free. If you can say no, you're free. You can say no and get away with it. And so then, once we get away from freedom being the ability to do as I please, a slightly more sophisticated view of freedom is the ability to say no. But that really isn't more sophisticated at all, because if I say no to somebody else, I'm saying yes to myself. And we're back again to doing as I please. Accepting the first doing as I please might be doing as I please when there's nobody who objects. And the further step of freedom is to do as I please, even when there is an external force objecting. Still to do as I please. That's already becoming a little bit more human. That a dog can't do so easily. A human being can master a dog. And the dog can do as he pleases as long as the balabos allows him to. But if the balabos is an effective animal trainer, he won't allow the animal to do as he pleases against the will of the balabos. And so, the more sophisticated view of freedom is to do as I please, even in the face of external opposition, to say no to somebody else because I'm saying yes to myself. That amount of freedom Sodom had. They were makir in the Ribbono Shel Olam, they knew God and they knew what he wanted, and they were able to say no and do as they pleased. They were free. But we say in Cheiru Selatiru, that's not freedom yet. Avraham achieved freedom. Avraham was able to say no not only to an external compelling force, but even to an internal compelling force. There is no greater compulsion in the human being than the desire to survive, the desire to live. And to be able to say no even to that desire, that's already a higher level in freedom. I am free not only from external forces, but I am free even from internal. Avraham Avinu is tested with his first nisoyon. All he knows is he's worked out intellectually, no prophecy, no nevuah. He's worked out intellectually that there is a Ribbono Shel Olam, and that demands a certain style of life. And if one doesn't give that style of life in its basic terms, then there's no purpose in life. And on the basis of that philosophy, Avraham Avinu is willing to sacrifice his life and to be thrown into the furnace. But it goes a step further. Just before we take it a step further, of course, we've answered our first question too. Avraham Avinu knew that it was inevitable that the king of Sodom was going to claim credit for making Avraham wealthy. Because just as his habit of doing as he pleased would not facilitate his changing his conduct by means of the acquisition of a new philosophy, so the exposition to the truth was not going to change his habit of being very attached to materialism. And very soon he would become reattached to materialism, and just as an inflated sense of entitlement leads one to believe that I am entitled to gratify myself and any of my desires, so an inflated sense of entitlement leads me to believe that whatever money I hold in my hand is mine. I have a right over it, it's mine. One tends to lose and to forget sight of the Ribono Shel Olam. And so Avraham knew that there was no way he could enter into any reception from the king of Sodom, because that would be turned to the advantage of the king himself. But Avraham's freedom goes one step further. Rebellia again asks the most wonderful kasha. He says the first of the 10 trials was an amazingly difficult trial. Avraham Avinu, never having been exposed to the Ribono Shel Olam, never having seen another Jew, another from Jew, having had no rabbein and no family background, uses his own intellect to sacrifice his life for that which he believes is true. Tremendous Mesiras Nefesh. The 10th trial, 10 trials later, 9 trials later, he's told by the Ribono Shel Olam to sacrifice his only son Yitzchak. But this is a different story already, says Rebellia. This time he's had Nevuah, he's had prophecy, he's been exposed to the Ribono Shel Olam. The Ribono Shel Olam is told that he's on the right path, he's doing the right thing. And it's that same Ribono Shel Olam who saved him from the furnace of fire, who tells him explicitly, sacrifice your son. What's the big Mesiras Nefesh, asks Rebellia. What's so hard about that? If it's absolutely clear. Good, emotionally it's difficult. But intellectually it's not difficult. Surely the first trial was far more difficult than the 10th. Surely to stand by your principles when you have no way of knowing whether they're true or not requires more Mesiras Nefesh than standing by a clear and equivocal instruction at Tzivui Hashem.
Nonsense rebellion.
The first trial demonstrated Avraham's freedom in that he was able to go against his will. He was able to do that which he didn't want to do, because he believed intellectually it was the right thing to do. So if we look at our principle of freedom, we can take it a little bit further. We started off by saying freedom is doing what you want. Then we said no, freedom is the ability to say no. But then we said no, that's also not good enough, because saying no to one party is saying yes to another. If I'm told to do something and I refuse, that's because I don't want to do it. So by saying no to the external compelling force, I'm saying yes to myself. So in the end, still I'm doing what I want. Here we come to our broader level of freedom, which is even greater. Saying no to myself because I'm saying yes to my mind. That's even a higher level. Not saying no to you because I'm saying yes to me. Within myself as well, there are now two views. There's me the emotional, there's me the animal, there's me the physical, and there's me the intellectual. And I'm able to say no to the physical. I'm able to say no to the emotional, because I'm saying yes to the intellectual. But even there, freedom is saying no to myself because I'm saying yes to myself. It's still self-centered. And we've got to get away from that concept of freedom. We've got to go further than that. The ultimate of freedom is saying no to every part of myself. The ultimate of freedom is to be able to say no to my emotions and to my material being and to my intellectual being. That's the ultimate in freedom, to be bound by no one.
Says Rebellia, that was the 10th test.
sacrificing his son went against his mind. It went against his philosophy. It went against his teachings. It went against his intellect. It went against everything he had struggled for his entire life. But it was at Tzivri Hashem, that he knew for sure. And that was a far greater Mesirus Nefesh. To say no to somebody else because you're saying yes to yourself is one level of freedom. To say no to your body because you're saying yes to your mind is a higher level of freedom. But to say no even to your mind because you're saying yes to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that is the ultimate freedom. To be able to subject your mind as well and say, not only are your actions wrong, Rabbi, but your thinking is wrong, your mind is wrong, everything you've taught and everything you've learnt is wrong, your whole life is wrong. To be able to say that is the ultimate of freedom. Sometimes one spends a long time learning the sugya of Gemara, and as one goes, one develops an idea, one goes a little bit further and one finds a proof for that idea, and one goes a little bit further and one finds a second proof, and then there's something very similar, and then one finds a kasha and an answer, and as one goes, this thing builds and builds, and one gets very excited, and one learns through the night developing the idea further, and eventually one thinks, good, it's ready to share with somebody else, and one gets some people together to listen to the way one's understood this complicated piece of Gemara, and in one's final rehearsal one finds it wrong. It's all very nice, but there's a Gemara somewhere else one's just come across which says the opposite. I must be wrong. To be able to say, my thinking is wrong, it can't be right. As attached as I am to it, as convinced as I am about it, as beautiful and as perfect as it looks, it needs to be abandoned because it's wrong. That's the ultimate in truth. To take one's actions and test to see, do they fit my mind? Do I agree that they're right? That requires a high level of humanity. But to take my mind and submit that to a higher authority and see whether my thinking is right, that's greatness altogether. And that's the greatness of Torah. We're told, Chochma b'goyim tam. If you're told that the goyim are wise, that there is wisdom among the non-Jews, you can believe that. There is. We know how elevatedly the Rishonim thought of people like Socrates, Aristotle, Plato. Their works are quoted. There's a perush of one of the Rishonim on the ethics of Plato. These were not works that they discarded as being of no value. And the Rambam talks exceptionally highly of Aristotle. Rebellion says that that wasn't only because of their intellectual wisdom. That's because they lived in accordance with that wisdom. That's Chochma b'goyim tam. If you're told that the goyim have wisdom, you can believe that. Torah b'goyim al tam. But if you're told they have Torah, don't believe that. Because Torah means not only taking my conduct and comparing that to my intellect, that taking my intellect and comparing that to God's intellect, the Torah, that only a Jew can do. To take his mind and say that my thinking must be wrong, as right as it looks and as logical as it appears, the conclusion is against the halacha, therefore it's wrong. That only a Jew can do. Only we have access to that ability and to that key. In fact, I wonder whether that isn't why the goyim, as a sign in the Western world, in the world that follows the Greeks, as a sign of respect and dedication and devotion, take their hats off. Because the highest is their head. There's nothing above the head. Whereas the Jew, as a sign of dedication, puts a hat on his head to remember that there is something higher than the head. The head itself is subservient to halacha. The head is not the ultimate. The Torah is the ultimate. And the head has to be aligned with the Torah. The intellect has to be aligned with halacha, and if it isn't aligned, it has to be adjusted. It can't be correct. It's
not sufficient to align one's actions with one's mind. That's a very important achievement. But one has to go further than that and align one's mind with the mind of the Ribbono Shel Olam.